Oh, you must be privy to some quite emotional revelations. Oh, and of course, here you're not far from the Bank of England, too. I expect those calls come through your exchange, money being so important to the country, to the government. We get all sorts of calls, like I said. They had reached the entrance to the Faraday buildings. Maisie looked up at the structure and then at Vivian Coombs. You've done well to secure a good position here, Vivian.
I had to work for it, Miss Dobbs. The civil service exams, memorizing exchanges, learning correct enunciation, all that sort of thing. And then you have to be tall. They only take you if you are over 5'6", otherwise you wouldn't be able to reach the top jacks on the board.
She looked at the top of Maisie's head as if to assess her height.
You'd be all right for this job, being as you're tall too.
Maisie smiled. Perhaps we can talk again, Vivian. You probably know so much about Joe that would be helpful, and I know it's difficult to discuss it, because the shock of his death is still very raw. Coombs's eyes filled with tears.
I just never thought it would come to this, that's all.
What do you mean, Vivian? That it would never come to what? She shrugged, composing herself.
That it would never come to it that Joe would be the first of us to go, that's all. Because he was the youngest. He shouldn't have been first. Now then, I've got to get back to work. Bye.
Maisie watched the telephonist vanish into a snake of young women making their way back through the sandbagged entrance to the Faraday buildings. Returning to a place where they were sworn to keep all manner of secrets, between husbands and wives, between lovers, government, departments, long-lost friends, and even, she thought, secrets concerning the movement of money. It was as Maisie walked away toward the underground station that she realized she had forgotten to impart an important piece of information to Vivian Coombs. She would have liked to let her know that young Private Billy Beale was home safe from the shores of Dunkirk, but perhaps it was best she hadn't, for as they'd walked away from the coffee house along streets flanked by sandbagged buildings, Maisie had taken a moment to mirror the way Vivian Coombs carried herself. So much was revealed in the way a person walked, and it was a simple technique, a means of understanding something of a person without their knowledge, but it was important to be distinct in the interpretation. By the time she made her way through the turnstiles at the underground station, Maisie was wondering how best to describe the waves of fear and regret she felt emanating from Vivian Coombs as she walked alongside her.
"Billy, look at this,"
said Maisie, pointing to the case map. She had been back in the office for only 20 minutes when Billy came in, his footfall heavy on the stairs before he entered.
"Aren't you even going to ask where I've been?"
said Billy.
"Any other employer would."
"I know where you've been, Billy. Your son is at home now, probably on a few days' leave before he has to report for duty again, and you wanted to see a bit more of him."
"He says I'm the only one he can talk to, that he can't talk to his mum about it, or his brother. And he definitely can't talk to his little sister. Won't even let her near him when she wants to give him a cuddle to make it all better. That's what she keeps saying. Let's make Billy all better, Daddy."
"Billy, you should be at home, really."
"Nah, he was sleeping when I left, like the dead. Got a nasty tear along the shoulder where a bullet just skimmed along. Could have killed him, miss. Could have killed my boy."
"But it didn't kill him. Someone was watching over him."
"My little Lizzie. That's who."
Billy took out a handkerchief and blew his nose.
"They've patched him up at the military hospital and sent him home for a few days."
Maisie pulled out a chair for Billy and leaned back. "It must have brought back a lot of difficult memories for you, Billy. Would you like to take the load off? And I don't mean your feet." Billy gave a half-laugh, slumping into the chair.
"I can't let it take me down again, miss. I'll need the backbone for our Billy."
He looked at his hands, then back to Maisie.
"But what he told me made me sick, miss. And he said, 'Dad, I was lucky. I got away early. It's bound to be worse now.
Go on, said Maisie.
Tell me all about it. And Miss, I don't know if I can bear to think about what's going on over there. Billy says the expeditionary force is being driven right back to the coast by the Germans. And I mean right back. There's men out there, our boys and the French, holding the line so more can get to the coast. And when they get there, they're lining up, masses of them, hoping to get onto a boat and sail for home. Some even tried to swim for it. And the bleeming Germans are coming down, flying above the beach and strafing the poor buggers. They're bombing the Navy ships and gunning them, coming in right overhead so the Navy boys can't get their big guns raised vertical enough to defend themselves. He saw one ship, a hospital ship, with a bleeming great red cross on it that you couldn't miss from Mars, and the Luftwaffe came in for the attack and it sunk in seconds. There were doctors and nurses on board, wounded and any other poor sods they could take. And Billy said he almost got on that one. The army's having to leave everything, tanks, guns, motor cars. I tell you, miss, a miracle got hold of my son, pushed him to the front of the queue and brought him home. Maisie said nothing, allowing silence to wrap itself around Billy's story. A minute passed before he looked up, pinched the bridge of his nose and sighed.
Now then, what was it you wanted me to look at, miss?
The case map. Here. Maisie's voice was little more than a whisper, as she pointed to a long red line between two names, then linking it to a third.
I should have seen it coming. If anyone's going to make money out of a war, it'd be that one.
I just don't have all the links in place, Billy. That's the trouble. I have to find the links.
I'll go over and...
Maisie shook her head. Not this time, Billy. Doreen's coping very well, all things considered, and I don't want her given cause to slip. Life is too fragile, isn't it? In fact, considering the situation, I am wondering about the future of the business, for the duration of the war, anyway.
You'll still be busy, mark my words.
That's not it, though I can see that pile of inquiries Sandra has left for me on the desk.
And this one, said Billy, tapping the case map, is one you're due in for nothing. No payment from anyone.
That's why there are some in that pile we have to start working on. There's nothing big in there, I just glanced through them, but enough to keep us on our toes. She reached for the sheaf of 6 or 7 inquiry messages and placed them on the table. I've just been considering how we should work. If the worst happens and there's an invasion or London is targeted by the Luftwaffe, it might be an idea to limit the time we spend here, don't you think? Billy shook his head.
Everyone has to go to work, miss. You can't let them win, not this easily.
I wasn't planning to lose anything, especially not by employees.
And I'll second what Billy said, said Sandra.
Maisie had not heard her enter the office.
Lawrence says life has to go on, so we're staying.
Maisie looked at Billy and Sandra. All right. That subject is out of bounds for now, but I may come back to it. Your safety is paramount in my book. She beckoned Sandra to a chair on the other side of the table bearing the case map. Indeed, we'll discuss it again when this case is closed. Right now it seems to be splitting open, wider, every day. With Billy dispatched to call upon 3 of the prospective new clients, Maisie spent some time with Sandra going over the afternoon's work, and then made her way downstairs to the front door. She had an appointment with her solicitor. As she closed the front door behind her, she heard someone calling after her.
Miss Dobbs? Miss Dobbs?
Mr. Miles, how are you? Walter Miles reached the top step of the stairs that led from the basement flat up to the street. Oh, and I must thank you once again for getting me out of a tight spot the other day.
I was wondering if everything was all right now. Are you safe?
Asked Miles.
I'm not sure I was particularly unsafe, but I didn't want to be followed by that motor car.
They have been back, you know, said Miles.
Maisie felt the familiar ice-cold sensation across her neck, as if a finger had traced the old wartime scar that was now hardly visible. "You've seen them?" He nodded.
"You weren't here, nor were your two friends, as I discovered. There were two men, one older, one younger. The older one waited across the road in the motor car, while the younger came toward the square, lingering over there with his newspaper and cigarette. When one of the students who lives upstairs left, the younger one sprinted across and caught the door just in time. I'd been tending my plants down there."
He pointed to a lower window, where a series of flowers struggled to bloom in terracotta pots.
"That area never catches the sun, but I try, though my ministrations are not as successful as they are in the courtyard at the bank. Anyway, I'd come up a few steps to look across. That's how I knew what was going on. I was worried that Mrs. Pickering was upstairs on her own with young Martin, so I went into my flat and then up to your office via the inside staircase. I found the man outside the door looking at the lock. It's a good one, isn't it?"
"What happened?"
"I asked him if he needed assistance, and he, very quickly, asked me if it was where Vivian lived. I told him he had the wrong address and sent him on his way. I would say he picked the name out of thin air. It was probably his mother's name, which is why it came to mind when he was put on the spot."
Maisie nodded. "Thank you, Mr. Miles. I am much obliged to you for looking out for us." She smiled, not wanting him to know her level of concern. "And thank you for being so thoughtful regarding the safety of my staff, especially Mrs. Pickering. I didn't know you'd already met."
"Oh, she always says hello. Such a nice young lady, and not often you see a woman working, following marriage, and especially now she has a child. I suppose times are changing. But that lock stood you in good stead."
"Yes, it certainly has been worth it." Maisie paused. "Actually, before her marriage to Mr. Pickering, she was a widow. Her first husband was killed in a terrible accident, but he had put in those locks for me when they were courting, and the subsequent tenant obviously kept them. I've leased the office twice, you see."
Miles nodded and began to retreat down the stairs, holding onto the railing for balance as he took each step. "I'd better get back to work, Miss Dobbs. Always much to do."
As she walked toward the tube station, Maisie considered two elements of the conversation with Walter Miles. First, the fact that the younger man Miles had intercepted had said he was looking for Vivian. The second was that Miles had seemed so easy to confide in. Sandra had clearly made his acquaintance to the extent that he was concerned for her safety, and for her part, she had told a story about Sandra's past, something that, as a rule, she wouldn't do. Now she was intrigued, though the intrigue did not extend to the man looking for Vivian. She already knew his identity. Chapter 14 4 days had passed since the service at Westminster Abbey, 4 days since Tim's disappearance. Later in the afternoon, Maisie would collect her motor car, pick up Priscilla, and the two would drive to Chelstone. Priscilla would be distracted from worrying about her son by the journey, then hopefully by life at Chelstone and being away until Monday, at least. The more she thought about it, the more sound Maisie considered her plan to limit the time she, Billy, and Sandra spent in the office during the week. Sandra was already working only on those days when administrative tasks had piled up, and she seemed to enjoy coming in. She and her husband were renting Maisie's old flat in Pimlico, and had made no plans to move despite having a new baby to consider. Lawrence's small publishing firm was located in London, and employed several people, so they could not up and move. Indeed, Sandra's fears, while expecting, of bringing a child into a country at war, seemed to have been put aside, which surprised Maisie. Billy lived outside the capital, and, if need be, could work from home on occasion, travelling as any investigation demanded. For her part, she was beginning to begrudge time spent in London when she could be in Kent, at the Dower House and closer to her family. Fortunately, as she had told Billy and Sandra, business was still coming in, and in fact seemed to have increased of late, which in turn could mean her plan might not work. The telephone was ringing when she entered the office. She ran to the desk and picked up the receiver. The caller addressed her before she could issue a greeting.
"Is that Miss Dobbs?"
"Yes, speaking," said Maisie, recognizing the voice.
"Clarissa Clark here. Do you have a moment, Miss Dobbs?"
With one hand, Maisie removed her hat.
"Of course, Dr. Clark."
"It's regarding Joseph Coombs. As you know by now, I have had to be less decisive in my report than I might have wanted to be. To be fair, it was entirely possible that the injury to the skull could well have taken place during a fall onto the railway lines. But that's not why I'm calling."
"Go on," said Maisie.
"I've been studying Joe's brain matter. By the way, I hope you don't mind me calling him Joe. The police don't always like it. They want to remain detached, claiming it makes them lose focus or some such thing. But Dr. Blanche taught us that we should speak to the dead by name. It helps us to remember respect and to keep our questions coming. I'm sure you know that. Anyway, I've always done it. I find it's led me up some very fruitful alleys of inquiry and reminds me I'm dealing with a human being who was alive and in the world until fate stepped in to stamp the time card."
She paused and Maisie heard a leaf of paper turn.
"Right. Anyway, as I said, I was studying Joe's brain matter and, as you know, it bothered me, this discoloration. So I spoke to a neurologist friend of mine because I know he's interested in diseases of the brain and how they affect behaviour. He came down to the lab here to have a look, and we've come to the conclusion that it's likely that Joe was suffering from more than the physical sensation of headache, but also dizziness and swings in mood. He might also have been sensitive to sound."
"Traffic and such like?"
"Yes."
"That explains one thing. He didn't want to go back to London. He wanted to leave his job and stay in the country working on a farm."
Psychology is more your bailiwick, but I would say the physical trauma to the brain, from whatever toxins he had been exposed to, would have led people to say such things as, Joe isn't himself these days."
"Yes, that's why his parents came to me. But what about the injury that killed him?"
"To be fair, it could just as well have happened as a result of a fall as a blunt instrument."
Clark sighed, and Maisie thought she sounded exasperated.
"There were tiny specks of cast iron in the hair and brain. But the railway line is iron, so that doesn't help. And the behaviour I've indicated might have led him to jump. My colleague has pointed that out."
Maisie picked up a pencil and tapped it on the desk, mindful of Clarissa Clark's position. "I applaud you for keeping an open mind, Dr. Clark. But I have a feeling you believe he was killed elsewhere. Since we spoke, have you encountered any evidence to suggest his death might have happened at another location?"
"That railway siding is a dirty, filthy place. People have thrown fish and chip wrappings over the wall as they passed on the road above, cigarette stubs, and even urinated onto the railway. There's over a century of accumulated debris down there, and it was last cleaned decades ago because it's not even used much for shunting engines back and forth these days. The station master likes everything to look ship-shape, where people can see the platform, but this part of the station is out of the way."
"So the rubbish on the line made it difficult to reach a final conclusion?"
"Not quite," said Clark. "In fact, I was a little surprised because, having been to the location where the body was found, I would have expected to see more evidence of debris from the site in the actual bone matter and hair and on the clothing. But I didn't. He either had a clean fall or he was laid there after the point of death. The police are quite within their rights to have asked for a declaration of death by misadventure. What I am telling you is just speculation."
"Your word counts for something, Dr. Clark."
"Which is why I have to leave the door open for the possibility that Joe jumped from the wall above, perhaps while in an unstable frame of mind."
"I think you want to add more," said Maisie. Clarissa Clark cleared her throat.
"Miss Dobbs, you are engaged in a search for the truth, are you not?"
Clark did not wait for a response from Maisie.
"Then you should follow the injury sustained by Joe before the wounds that took his life. Look at what happened to his brain before his skull was cracked open. That's what killed Joe.
whether he jumped or not. In my humble opinion, of course.
It's a web, though.
I deal with them every day. Dr. Blanche gave us sage advice in order to untangle them. Patience. And one thread at a time.
Maisie smiled. I've been thinking the same thing lately. Your conclusion confirms I'm going in the right direction. Thank you.
Of course. Now then, I have to get to work. Joe's remains will be released to his family for burial soon, but I assure you I have kept copious notes and also brought in a medical artist. It's something I do at times if I feel it necessary.
As evidence?
Yes, indeed. Now, I must go. Good day, Miss Dobbs.
Thank you for telephoning, Dr. Clark. Maisie replaced the receiver. Much of the pathologist's report was already known to Maisie, but she appreciated having her suspicions substantiated by Clark. She also rather liked speaking to a woman known for never having had a humble opinion in her life. Maisie crossed the room to the window and looked down at the explosion of colour now gracing Walter Miles's postage stamp yard below. Her own walled garden, Holland Park, was much larger, and laid to lawn with shrubs around the perimeter and various vines clinging onto the bricks, wisteria, clematis, climbing roses. A gardener came in once a fortnight, and though she kept it tidy enough in the interim, she would never have considered herself proficient in the realm of horticulture. Indeed, the flowering vines in Miles's yard were much further along than her own, and her garden received more direct sunlight, so it should have been equally abundant. Miles clearly had more than a green thumb. He was a gifted gardener. A book had been left on the small table, half read and upside down to keep the place. There was a cardigan over the back of one chair and a notebook, as if he had only just left his seat. She wondered whether he worked, and if so, what his profession might be. She was curious about Walter Miles.
"Morning, miss," said Billy, entering the office.
"Oh, hello, Billy. Everything all right?"
"Our Billy is still spending most of the day in bed, but that's to be expected. He's received orders to be back at barracks on Monday for a medical exam, so the doctor can look at that wound and tell him whether he's well enough for service, or if he gets signed off for a bit longer. And Monday isn't many days to go, so I said to Doreen that he should try to be up and about today. Get Margaret Rose to nag him a bit to take her to the park when she comes home from school. He thinks the world of his little sister, and I know it's probably a bit odd, a man of his age having a young sister, but it would do him the power of good, I think, to go out to the park for a bit of a play."
Maisie looked over toward Billy.
"What? What did I just say?"
asked Billy. "You just referred to Billy as a man. Not a boy and not a lad. You called him a man. And I think you're quite right. Playing with a child will do him the power of good. You don't have much time to lighten the load on his shoulders."
"I'd like to see mine lightened, miss."
Billy shook his head.
"I signed the papers for Bobby last night. That's one thing his brother said to me. He said, 'Dad, if our Bobby is in the RAF as a mechanic, the chances are they can't send him anywhere they can send me. And he reckoned his brother would be a lot safer on the ground, working on aircraft engines, so I signed it, and even his mother said I should. Bobby is now as happy as a sand boy, which is a mercy, as that face was getting as long as a week, and there's only so many miserable faces you can bear at the dinner table. Thank our lucky stars for Margaret Rose. She's our gem, truly she is.'"
He exhaled and continued relating family business.
"So, you could say I've got two men now," he nodded toward the window. "And what's Farmer Miles up to out there? Putting a row of potatoes yet?"
Maisie laughed. "No, but he's certainly trying to better Kew Gardens. I'm amazed he has managed to do so much. Remember how that used to look? Then the last tenant tried to make an improvement, but it took Mr. Miles to really change that yard into a very small, small holding.
He had some operations on his legs, but he's got his strength back, I would imagine."
How come you and Sandra know so much about Walter Miles? And I didn't even know he lived there until a week ago. Who is he?
I was told by the woman at the dairy shop across the square that she'd seen him quite a few times before he moved into the flat. He'd come in for some odds and ends, and then one day he told her he wanted to live in the square. She said he'd been looking for a certain sort of rooms, both a front and a back entrance and a small yard, like the one he's got, so it all came right for him. He'd just come back from living in the south of France, apparently. He returned to see his doctor. The stairs at the front aren't too bad for him, and of course, he can just let himself out the back if he wants to. I've heard he's a lecturer at the university over on Mallet Street.
Really? Then he's probably Dr. Miles. What does he teach?
Oh, I think you'd have to ask Sandra that one.
I just don't know how I missed all this.
You weren't paying attention. You rush in and rush off. And he's not exactly out there all the time waiting, is he? He keeps to himself. Oh, he's been out on the front a few times when I've come in. And he's always friendly, interested in people who live round the square, passes the time of day, and then goes on his way, or back downstairs.
Maisie shook her head.
Well, I never. Anyway, I want to talk to you about the Coombs case.
We're close, aren't we?
Maisie nodded. Yes, in a way we are. I know the people, and I think I know the why, but bringing them to justice will be difficult, not least because the solid evidence is proving hard to nail down. I have lots of pieces, but making them fit is quite another thing.
What do you think we should do next?
I'm leaving for Kent later today, taking Mrs. Partridge down to Chelvestone, and then tomorrow we're driving along the coast from Rye to Ramsgate, stopping at every possible place where Tim and his friend might come in with the boat, which will be tricky considering all the barbed wire laid across the beaches. But my money is still on Rye. Admittedly, there's that long journey along the River Rother estuary to the channel, but it's home for the boys, where they've always sailed from together.
On the case?
I think it should stew in its own juices for a few days, but with a little help. I'm going along to see Phil and Sally Coombs in a minute, try to get them before opening time. I'm sure that somewhere there's a connection with those Robertsons.
There is, but not probably what you're looking for, said Billy.
What do you mean? Said Maisie.
I made a note of it so I'd remember to tell you before you went out today, and I only reminded myself yesterday evening.
Go on, Billy. Maisie moved to the large table and sat down, pulling back another chair for her assistant to be seated alongside her. She unfurled the case map and brought the tin filled with coloured crayons closer. Billy placed his notebook on the table and unfolded a press cutting. He ran a palm across the scrap of newspaper, making it as flat as possible before pushing it toward Maisie. She looked down at a row of faded faces, young men in uniform, smiling at the camera, as if sharing a joke at the photographer's expense. "Are you in this?" asked Maisie.
"No, not me. Never wanted to get my name in the paper. This was sent to me by my mum in the war because one of my cousins was in the photograph. Here, you can see it says, London boys leave for France to take on the Hun. They're all lined up, waiting to get on the boat, see? That's Arthur, my cousin, mum and her sister, my aunt. Said we always favoured brothers more than cousins. He was in the artillery, though. I was showing Billy my war photographs last night. Pictures of me and the lads I was with over in France. I was trying to sort of get him to talk a bit, letting him know I understood how things are when you're soldiering.
Maisie was already running her finger along the line of men. Who am I looking for? There's someone here you want me to see, isn't there?
Right there, miss. You have to take account of time, don't you? But I think that's Phil Coombs. Look, if you can imagine Archie, he's the dead spitting image of his dad when he was his age. That's what made me stop and look again.
It's hardly surprising he was in the army, though. There's more, isn't there?
You ever seen a photo of Jimmy Robertson?
Not recently, no, said Maisie.
I was a bit late today because I had to go down to see my mate, the one who works for the Express. We went down to the newspaper storage place and we found a picture of Robertson from a few years ago, when he was hauled up for armed robbery, and the beak let him off. You see, I'd seen more recent photos in the papers, and it seemed to me that the bloke right there could be him. And it was him, there, next to Phil Coombs, in the artillery together.
And someone like Jimmy Robertson doesn't forget anyone, because the anyone in question could be useful later. Maisie looked at the grainy cutting again, taking care not to tear the thinning folds. "Can I keep this?"
"It's all yours, miss. I never wanted it in the first place. When Mom said this to me, she wrote in the letter, 'How come you can't get into the papers and make me famous on the street?' Which was a bit rich, if you ask me.
I'll bring it back, Billy. This is part of your family's history, after all. You might change your mind." She placed the photograph in her bag.
"Now then, I'm off to see Phil," said Maisie. "Any luck with those new inquiries?"
"Two on the go, miss. One woman thinks she's just married an officer in the Navy who's married to someone else, and another who only really wanted some company, I reckon. She asked me about her missing watch and necklace, but I found them for her before 20 minutes was up. Then she wanted me to stay for a cup of tea and insisted on paying me for the time. I'll put it in petty cash. She was just lonely, I reckon. Sad, eh?"
Maisie nodded and passed a crayon to Billy. "Would you do the honours and bring us up to date?" She tapped it onto the desk in front of him and gave a half-smile, knowing he was put out that she intended to see Phil and Sally Coombs on her own.
"Look, I know you want to be helping with this case, but as soon as Jimmy Robertson's name came up, I knew we had to proceed with care." She sighed.
"Billy, you almost died a few years ago, and even if you can't remember because you were in a coma, I remember the effect it had on Doreen. I can't risk that again, which is why I want you to take charge of the new cases, just for now."
Billy shook his head. "But you could be walking right into danger, and you've got little Anna to consider. I know she's only your evacuee, but there's more to it than that. We've all got people to take account of, but this is what we do, after all. And haven't you always said we've got to get to work when truth comes to us for help? Or something like that, anyway?"
"Oh, touché, Billy, touché." She paused and dropped the crayon.
"All right, come on. Let's get over there to see Phil and Sally, but take my lead, as I don't want to show too much of my hand, just enough. Then we'll let it simmer like I said we would, all right?"
Billy grinned.
"Ready when you are, miss."
Phil Coombs came down from the upstairs flat the third time Billy rapped on the door.
"Thought you'd all left home, mate," said Billy. "Oh, good morning, Miss Dobbs. Billy," he looked from one to the other, "got any news for us?"
"I'm sorry, but we've a few more questions, if that's all right," said Maisie, stepping into the deserted public bar when Phil Coombs stood back to allow them to enter. The smell of stale smoke and the yeasty odour of yesterday's beer was overpowering. Dust motes danced and settled in a shaft of sunlight, slanting through the window to the dark-stained floor. Coombs led the way up the narrow staircase to the flat above and called out to his wife.
"Sally, got company? Miss Dobbs and Mr. Beale. About Joe?"
Sally Coombs stood in the doorway to the kitchen, drying her hands on a tea towel.
"Oh, hello. Come in. I've just put the kettle on."
"What time does Vivian start work in the morning?" asked Maisie, taking the seat proffered by Phil Coombs.
8:30, as a rule."
He sat down opposite Maisie.
"Sometimes it's earlier. Usually, though, when the women finish their day, the men telephonists come on for the night shift. She's a clever girl. Top marks in her civil service exams."
Maisie engaged Phil in small talk about Vivian's prospects until Sally had placed cups of tea on the table and taken a seat. She paused, stirring her tea and taking a sip before speaking again. "I want to go back over Joe's apprenticeship, if I may. How did he find out about the job at Yates? Wasn't it someone you knew who put in a word for him?" Phil Coombs glanced at his wife, then at his hands, as he answered.
It was through Archie, who found out from his mate, Teddy Wickham.
And how did Teddy know about the opening?
Can't say as I remember now, but must have been through someone he knew, who does business with Yates, or a relative. Teddy was looking out for Joe, and thought it would be a good start for him to learn the trade, like I said before. Being in a trade sets you up, and he did well to get in at Yates.
He drummed his fingers on the table. Right, yes, I know you wanted him to become a skilled craftsman. Are you sure you can't recall who gave Teddy the tip-off? Coombs shook his head and turned to his wife.
Sal, can you remember?
Sally Coombs shook her head.
Can't say as I do.
Maisie continued. I remember you saying that Joe had changed. When do you think that started? Coombs looked at his wife again, as if her face would jog his memory. She raised her eyebrows and sighed.
I reckon it was after he'd been put on this new job a month or so. Before the headaches, if I'm remembering rightly, said Sally.
Nah, the headaches came before. Don't you remember me saying Joe's been very quiet when he gets on the blower?
He looked at Billy as if the father of sons would understand.
Then when he came home one Saturday afternoon, he didn't want to go out much. Said it was being in the country made him not like all the noise out there.
And what about his wish to give up his job because he wanted to work on a farm? Coombs rolled his eyes.
Oh, that business. Might have known that would come up. Joe had this idea. He wanted to be a farmer. Said he'd been offered an apprenticeship by a local bloke with a farm. All on the up and up, it was supposed to be.
He stared at Maisie.
Give up a good job to be planting turnips. The boy was off his rocker.
By all accounts, he loved the country, said Maisie. You said so yourself when we first spoke.
No, I told him he had to stay with Yates. You don't give up a good job.
Phil Coombs looked at the clock and pushed back his chair.
Getting on for opening time.
Just another minute or two, Mr. Coombs, it's important, said Maisie. She cast her gaze from Coombs to his wife. What would really have been the consequence of Joe leaving his job at Yates?
I don't know what you mean. Mind you, there's always a consequence of giving up work. Joe remembered how it was when he was younger. Grown men on the streets begging for money to keep their families fed. Lining up for work time and again, saw it myself, and we vowed that was not going to happen to our boys.
Sally Coombs looked at her husband.
And I knew the consequence of going into the army, added Coombs. I saw enough myself in the last war. You did as well.
He brought his attention to Billy, then Maisie.
There's consequences your mum and dad know about that you don't, when you're still wet behind the ears. And Sally and me, we knew it was our job to steer our children on the right path. Ours learned how to put in a day's work, and they knew they weren't going to fight any wars, not if I had anything to do with it. Joe's job was reserved, and so was Archie's. Vivian wouldn't be in uniform either.
Maisie nodded as Coombs took account of the hour again, shifting in his chair as if to render it obvious he was checking the clock. 1 minute, then we'll let you get on, Phil. Do you know how Mike Yates managed to obtain the contract for painting aerodromes? And have you any idea about the source of the paint Joe's crew were using?
How would I know? Said Phil Coombs.
Maisie came to her feet. Billy followed her lead. I wondered about it, that's all. Again she turned from Phil to Sally Coombs. You see, if my son were being killed by a certain substance, I would want to know exactly where it came from. She turned to leave.
Now, Miss Dobbs, I know he wasn't feeling well, but...
The paint was toxic, said Maisie. It was poisoning his blood. and affecting his brain, Joe knew it, and he knew, if only by instinct, that he had to get away from it. And the only person who truly listened to him was a farmer, a man who had lost his son in the last war. As they reached the door, Maisie turned back. "I'm sorry to be so blunt, but that is the way it stands. I am trying to find out who killed Joe, and I have to do all I can to turn not only stones to see what lies underneath, but in this case, I have to move boulders. The truth can hide in some very troubling places, Mr. Coombs, and you asked me to find out the truth."
"I know about war, Miss Dobbs. I fought in the war."
"Yes, I'm aware you were in Flanders, as was Billy, and I was a nurse in a casualty clearing station, so I know how it was." She paused. "In fact, Billy showed me that newspaper cutting today. You were a local somebody for a short while after appearing in the South London press. How many of you came home from the lads in that photograph?"
"You had that photo,"
said Coombs, his face registering surprise.
"Arthur Beale, artillery, Parsondale, 1917. He was my cousin," said Billy. "Oh, blimey," said Coombs. "I never knew."
"No need for you to have known. I've got a common name, and it's not as if we talk about it, is it?"
Coombs stared at the ground and nodded.
"Not as if we do." He looked up. "Only two of us came back of the lads in that photograph," said Coombs.
"Yes, I already know," said Maisie. "I'll be in touch, and thank you, Mr. Coombs, Mrs. Coombs." They began walking back to the office without speaking until Billy broke the silence.
"Not like you to be so hard on someone, miss. Never heard you talk like that to people grieving. Fair surprised me it did."
"Sorry, Billy. There's a time for everything, and this was a time when I needed to poke with a knife instead of a gentle touch with a fingertip."
"Why?"
Maisie sighed. "Let's just see what happens next, then I'll explain." She stopped and turned to her assistant. "Trust me, Billy."
"Always have, miss. I always have. But what do you want me to do next?"
Maisie began walking again. "There is something before you start on the next three cases that came in. I want you to find out more about Teddy Wickham."
"What about him?"
"His parents. Mother's maiden name, that sort of thing. Uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, school, best friends. Though we know his best friend is Archie Coombs."
"Right you are, miss. Good is done."
Walter Miles emerged from the downstairs flat and greeted them as they reached the steps leading to the office. He was wearing a cream linen summer blazer with beige trousers and brown leather shoes and wore a white open-neck shirt. He carried a brown leather document case and used a cane to steady his walk. Passing the cane to the opposite hand, he raised his cream straw fedora. Maisie realized that, despite the scar along his jawline, Miles was a very handsome man and somewhat reminiscent of her late husband.
"Good day to you, Miss Dobbs. Mr. Beale?"
"Good morning," Maisie and Billy replied in unison. "You're like the number 36 bus," continued Maisie. "We don't see much of you, and then here you are several times in a row."
"I'm on my way to the university now," said Miles,
his smile broad as he regarded Maisie. "What do you teach?" she asked.
"Botany, usually, though with a few colleagues being called up, I'm now teaching other sciences as needed, and I'm often at Bedford College, as well as Mallet Street. Anyway, I'd better be off, or I'll be late."
He lifted his hat to signal his departure and gave another smile. Maisie watched as Miles made his way toward Warren Street.
"Seems to be a good bloke, eh, miss?"
"Yes, very nice indeed."
"He might be sweet on you," added Billy. "I haven't seen him much. Then, like you said, there he is a few times in a row."
"That doesn't mean anything, Billy."
"It meant something that day Mr. Stratton came to take you out to lunch. Last month it was."
"I don't understand. What do you mean?"
Oh, you two were off across the square, going out to have lunch somewhere, and I was leaving to see one of our new clients. Up comes Mr. Miles from his downstairs flat and says, Miss Dobbs seems to have a nice gentleman. Of course, I told her Mr. Stratton was only a friend, someone you'd worked with. And then he asked what he did. And so I told him Mr. Stratton used to be with the police before he left to become a teacher, but has to come into London for war work now. I think Mr. Miles was a bit downcast, you know, as if you were walking out with Mr. Stratton, and he was sad about it. I think you're seeing things, Billy, said Maisie. Perhaps he'll come up and invite you down for a cuppa. Oh, I don't know about that, really, I don't. Later in the office, as she packed papers she might need during her absence, Maisie walked across to the window to look down at the garden Walter Miles had created. She found it calming to stand there. Perhaps it took a botanist to have such luck in a postage stamp yard, where sunlight only seemed to flash through at certain times of day. Chapter 15. It felt quite bad going to Ramsgate, to tell you the truth, said Priscilla, flicking ash from her cigarette out of the open passenger side window. I mean, there I was, jumping up and down, talking to anyone who looked official, trying to find out if they knew where my son was. And they had enough on their hands dealing with the men coming off the boats without a lunatic mother screaming at them. She coughed and patted her chest. I don't know whether that's the gasper I'm puffing away on or all this fresh air. Lovely to have a motor car with a roof you can put down, though. I adored driving with the wind in my hair when we lived in Biarritz. She paused. Sometimes I wish we'd have bloody well stayed there, because now I have a son in the Air Force and another who thinks he's Lord Horatio Bloody Nelson. It's best you're not in Biarritz, Pris. Not with what's happened in France, and you know it. Maisie shifted gears as she slowed to drive through Chelstone. I absolutely adore this village, Maisie. Perhaps I should sell the family home and buy something here. It would make sense, because we hardly ever use the house now, and I've only kept it, really, for the memories. But I think Kent would be so much more convenient, after all. We would be in the country, yet there's the train or the coach to go back and forth from London. At that moment, a trio of RAF Spitfires flew overhead. Then, of course, I remember that Kent has taken the brunt of invasions for centuries, and I don't particularly want to be on the front line, she added, shielding her eyes with a hand to follow the aircraft until they disappeared into the clouds. Wouldn't it be simply the strangest thing if one of those boys were my son flying off to France? She turned to Maisie, then raised a palm to blow a kiss in the direction of the aircraft. Nearly there, said Maisie. Brenda will have baked a bounty of cakes, I'm sure. Thank heavens for your chickens and their eggs, said Priscilla. Maisie pulled into the lane leading to the back of the Dower House, parking the Elvis under a tree. Tomorrow will be the last time I can drive. It has to go into the garage until after the war now. I can't push my luck with the special allowance anymore. Ours has gone into storage, too. Going to Ramsgate was its swan song until this war is finished, said Priscilla. And there's your greeting party, she added, pointing to the back door of the Dower House. Frankie Dobbs stood on the threshold holding Anna's hand. The child was in her pajamas, her feet drumming the ground, running on the spot as she waved to Maisie. Maisie stepped from the motor car as Frankie relinquished his hold on Anna's hand. The little girl ran to Maisie, Emma ambling from behind Frankie to remain close to her mistress.
You're home! You're home! You're home!
And you've forgotten your slippers, your slippers, your slippers, young lady, said Maisie, lifting the child and holding her on her hip. My, for a little girl who's had the measles, you're getting heavy. And what time is this? It's past time for a measled girl to be in her bed.
Hello, Auntie Priscilla, said Anna, as Maisie let her slither to the ground.
Hello, Anna, said Priscilla, leaning forward and tapping her own nose and cheeks. One there, and one on the other side.
Anna giggled and kissed Priscilla on both cheeks and her nose as instructed, then reached for Maisie's hand.
"Tim's coming back tomorrow," she said, leading Maisie and Priscilla into the kitchen.
The women exchanged glances.
"Hello, love," said Frankie, kissing his daughter. "She's gone on and on about Tim coming home all day."
He looked at Priscilla, who had moved to kiss him in greeting.
"Sorry, Mrs. Partridge. I told her to keep her dreams a secret because I wouldn't want you to be upset. But Anna's been waiting for Maisie and you to get here. She was so excited she couldn't rest."
"What will upset me is you not calling me Priscilla. How many years have I known you now, Mr. Dobbs?"
She paused and pulled a face.
"Oh, dear. I don't practice what I preach, do I?"
At that moment, Brenda entered the kitchen.
"Hello, Mrs. Partridge. I've made up the guest room for you and Mr. Partridge, and we'll put Tarkin in the conservatory when he gets here. Tim always loves sleeping there."
"That's perfect, Mrs. Dobbs. Thank you so very much."
Priscilla turned to Maisie. "And I suppose you're still bedding down in the library?" "It's very comfortable, and if I can't sleep, there's plenty of reading material to get on with." She reached for Anna's hand.
"Now, while you all catch up with your news, I'm taking Anna upstairs. It's time she was in bed again. We don't want all the excitement to set her back."
Maisie was stretched out on top of the covers reading a story, with Anna in bed resting against the crook of her arm, when Brenda entered with a mug of warm milk.
"Looks like she's not far off sleep now," said Brenda.
"Almost in the land of Nod, aren't you?" said Maisie, sweeping a tendril of black hair across Anna's forehead, away from her eyes. "Come on, time for your milk." As Anna reached for the mug and began to sip, Maisie continued to support the child who was leaning against her.
"Heard from your Mr. Klein, Maisie?" asked Brenda, standing by the door.
"Yes, I saw him this week. It was a short meeting, not very long at all."
"And?"
Maisie shrugged, not looking at Brenda, paying attention to Anna as she finished her milk.
"Just a few little things to get over."
"Oh,"
said Brenda.
"We'll talk about it later."
"Yes," said Maisie. Brenda left the room as Anna took a final sip and handed the mug to Maisie.
"A widow is a lady whose husband has died, isn't she?"
said Anna. "Yes, that's right." Maisie stood up and set the mug on the side table. She had answered the question as if it were the most ordinary inquiry. "Now then, snuggle down and close your eyes, ready for the Sandman."
"I know your husband died,"
whispered Anna.
"Yes, you probably heard someone mention it," said Maisie.
"It's not a secret, but I don't talk about it much."
"Lady Rowan came over to read to me when I first had measles. I heard her talking to Auntie Brenda downstairs. She said it doesn't help that you're a widow."
"Probably because sometimes being a widow makes other people sad," said Maisie.
"Who's Mr. Klein?"
asked Anna, resting her head on the pillow.
"He's what they call a solicitor, a man who draws up papers to do with the law."
"Did he draw up papers for you because you're a widow?"
"Yes, he helped me with all sorts of things," said Maisie.
"Is he drawing up papers so you can keep me?"
Maisie knelt down at the side of the bed and held Anna's hand. Emma, who had been lying close to the door, raised her nose.
"What made you say that, Anna?"
The child looked into Maisie's eyes.
"Because you want me. That's what Nanny said before she went to heaven. She told me that everything would be all right because the lady wanted me."
Upon reaching Hastings at 10 o'clock the following morning, Maisie parked the motor car close to the Stade, the shingle beach that was home to the town's fishing fleet. Most had returned home with the morning's catch several hours earlier, though one of the heavy clinker-built boats had just been winched ashore.
"Wait a moment, Pris. I won't be long,"
said Maisie as she took one of several bottles of water she had packed in the motor car and walked across the shingle to speak to a fisherman. He was standing to one side, his waxed overalls and jacket sodden and stained, his face and hands black with oil and sweat. She uncorked the bottle and passed it to him. He nodded his appreciation.
"You've come back from Dunkirk, haven't you?"
The man drank several mouthfuls and nodded again.
"I wonder if you could help me. My friend's son and another boy went out in a launch, a 45-footer. They've not come in, and I wondered if, as you were making your way back, you saw a vessel returning in this direction. She's usually moored at the harbour in Rye, so not far."
He shook his head, took one more long draw from the bottle, and wiped his mouth against his sleeve, spreading another line of oil across his cheek.
"Can't say as I have, love."
The man leaned back against the boat behind him and sank down to sit on a mound of nets.
"Sorry. We only just came in."
He raised the bottle as if in a toast.
"Much obliged to you. Much obliged."
"Thank you, sir. Thank you for going over there."
"It was terrible. Never get the pictures out of my head, never. Once seen, never forgotten."
He closed his eyes. Maisie moved to walk away, then heard the fisherman speak again.
"Just because I never saw the boat, don't mean it weren't there."
He sipped more water and nodded toward the boat that had just been winched in.
"It was all I could do to get us back here, what with her taking on water. Didn't like to leave because there's still more to bring home. Brave boys, all brave boys, and your lads might have been out there, I just never saw them. 'Twas all I could do to see my way home."
"Thank you, sir,"
she called out, raising her hand to bid him farewell again.
"Now,
Rye," said Maisie as she reached the motor car and opened the driver's door. Priscilla took one final draw on her cigarette, this time without the holder, threw it down and ground it into the dirt with the toe of her shoe. At Rye, there was no sign of the Cassandra, but as Maisie and Priscilla left the motor car to walk across to the harbour, a member of the local constabulary approached to query Maisie's authority for running a motor car, and also asked to see her motor spirit coupons and both their identity cards. They complied with the request.
"All looks in order, madam, but I wouldn't chance another run in that motor car. And I hope you've got a full tank there, because there's not much to be had at the petrol stations."
"Yes, fortunately, and my vehicle is going into storage tomorrow. We just had to make this last journey along the coast looking for my friend's son."
She explained what had happened with Tim and his friend Gordon.
"Oh, yes. Know the Cassandra. And now I come to think of it, I've seen those boys before, taking out one of the father's boats. Got a veritable fleet, the Sandersons. Sailing family through and through."
Maisie was aware of Priscilla's mounting frustration as her friend tapped her foot and folded her arms. "Here's my telephone number, Constable," said Maisie, handing the man a calling card onto which she had written the Dower House number. "I know you're a very busy man, but perhaps someone could place a call to me should this particular member of the fleet return." He nodded and placed the card in his breast pocket.
"Right you are, madam. I'll keep an eye out. So you said you're making your way along the coast?"
"Yes, we are," interjected Priscilla. "It stands to reason my son and his friend will end up somewhere between here and Ramsgate, so we're on our very own personal patrol to find them."
The man smiled as if to mollify Priscilla, then turned back to Maisie.
"Drop into the constabulary at every town, madam. Tell them you've already spoken to me. Constable Shearing from Rye. We're all doing what we can for the boys coming in, and the boats that bring them, so my colleagues along the way will give you a hand, and if they can, they'll let you know if he's coming."
His eyes met Priscilla's once again.
"Your son and young Gordon are courageous boys, madam. They're made of the best of us all."
"Yes, quite," said Priscilla, who turned and walked away.
"Her other son is in the RAF, so she's not herself," explained Maisie, as she watched Priscilla light another cigarette.
"Didn't think so," said the constable.
I wouldn't want to be in her shoes. I'll let you know if I find out anything.
Maisie nodded, thanked the man, and walked back to Priscilla.
Sorry about that, said Priscilla.